It's time. Time to get inspired and empowered. To realize it's never too late. To create your next amazing story. Get ready to break through, transform, and start living the life of your dreams. So, are you ready? Truly ready to begin your journey to create your next amazing story in life and love? Great. Let's jump in with your host, Life and Love Transformational Coach, Suzanne Oshima.
Welcome, everybody, to the It's Never Too Late show. I'm Suzanne Oshima, and I'm a Life and Love Transformational Coach at Your Next Amazing Story. I'm so excited because today we have a very special guest, Dr. Glenn Livingston, and he's a clinical psychologist. And today we're talking about It's Never Too Late to Stop Binging. So welcome, Dr. Livingston.
Please call me Glenn. It's nice to be here.
Hi, ladies. Well, Glenn, can you share with the ladies, because I think this is a bit unusual. I've never met a psychologist that specializes in binging and overeating. So can you share with the ladies how you got into this?
Yeah. And I do this more as an educator and a coach than a clinical psychologist, because as you'll see, I've got a different approach that's not necessarily in concert with the psychological treatments that are out there today. So, I'm not just a doctor who decided to work with overeaters. I'm a guy who had a very serious overeating problem myself. So if you've ever been to a 7-Eleven and maybe they were out of Pop-Tarts or Twinkies, then I probably got there before you. I was responsible for that. But when I was about 17, I'm 6'4", I'm kind of muscular, and I figured out that I could eat whatever I wanted to if I worked out for 2 hours a day. And I didn't think that was a problem. I thought it was great. It was a great way to live. I was thin and handsome, and I was getting away with it. And I just spent an awful lot of time eating 6,000 or 7,000 calories a day and exercising a lot and sleeping it off. But you know, what's life about when you're 17? When I got older and I was 22, 23, and I was married, I didn't have the time. I was commuting 2 hours a day each direction to go to school, go to graduate school. I had patients. My wife wanted to talk to me. Imagine that. And there just wasn't time. But I found that I couldn't put the food down. It had a life of its own, and I still wanted, you know, whole pizzas and boxes of muffins and boxes of chocolate bars, and anything that really wasn't nailed down was fair game. It bothered me on two fronts. First of all, I was getting fat. And my top weight, I was probably about 280. I stopped weighing myself at 257. And my triglycerides were through the roof, and the doctors were telling me I was going to die. But probably more importantly, I was obsessed with food. I would be sitting with a suicidal patient and thinking about when I could get to the deli. And I couldn't be – I mean, I never lost anybody, but I come from a family of 17 psychotherapists, and being a great psychologist is all I ever wanted to be in this world. And it really bothered me that I couldn't lend people my soul. I could do all the intellectual parts of psychology, so I could piece together what was going on in their life and what mistakes they were making and what they really needed to do. But I couldn't lend them my soul so that they would love me and trust me enough that they'd be willing to do it. So I wasn't as effective as I really could be because I was obsessed with food. Being from the family I was from, sometimes if you have a hammer, you think everything looks like a nail. And so I figured there must be a hole in my heart. The reason that I'm trying to fill the hole in my stomach is because there's a hole in my heart. And if I could just figure out how to love myself enough, then I'm going to stop trying to love myself with food. And I tried fixing it like that for 20, 30 years. I went to all the best psychologists and psychiatrists. You might imagine I knew them from the family I was from in New York. I went to Overeaters Anonymous for a lot of years. I even conducted my own study of 40,000 people on the internet to ask them what they were stressed about in their life and what bothered them with food. And it was a very soulful journey, but it didn't really help me to stop overeating. I mean, it would work a little bit at times. I'd get thinner, then I'd get a bunch heavier, and like heavier than when I started. And I kind of kept on that pattern for a while. And eventually, there were three things that happened that changed the paradigm and brought a solution to my mind. And so rather than trying to love my inner wounded child or nurture myself thin, I decided that I had to be more like an alpha wolf, and that these urges were coming from my bodily organs, just like an urge to go to the bathroom or an urge to kiss an attractive woman. I don't go to the bathroom unless it's time to go to the bathroom. Like, I, right. you know, I might have to go to the bathroom right now, but I tell my bladder that we're going to wait because I'm in control. I don't kiss attractive women on the street. You know, I find there's a time and a place to, actually, I'm not very good at approaching people on the street. That's another story. And I similarly realized that, well, maybe I could be more like an alpha wolf dealing with a challenger for leadership. And when an alpha wolf is challenged for leadership, it doesn't say, oh my goodness, someone needs a hug. It says, get back in line or I'll kill you. So it really takes control and asserts its superiority, which was hard for me because it's not my personality. I'm kind of a soft teddy bear, compassionate kind of guy. But there were three things that were in my face that really overwhelmingly convinced me that this was the case. First of all, I was doing a lot of consulting for industry. I never had children, and I didn't commute because my ex-wife traveled for business. And so I had a lot of time on my hands. I had a dual career, and I consulted for big food. And I saw, when I saw the inner workings, I saw that they were engineering these hyper-palatable concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and oil and excitotoxins. And it's all designed to hit our bliss point without giving us enough nutrition to feel satisfied. So they're really trying to overwhelm our sense of when we're full, when we should stop, and actually overwhelm our sense of when we're hungry and we should start also. Then I looked at the advertising industry, and most people think that advertising doesn't affect them. But the truth is, it affects you more if you think it doesn't affect you, because your resistance is down, your cell's resistance is down. And there's so much money spent on advertising, and they're very, very good at packaging and sending out messages to convince us that we can't live without this stuff. For example, I remember consulting for a major food bar manufacturer, and the most profitable thing that they told me they ever did was to take the vitamins out of the bar and put the money into the packaging instead. And they made the packaging look diverse and colorful and shiny, like a big salad. And they were telling our brains, hey, there's vitamins in here, but there's not, right? So, and that's, I don't mean to pick on them. That's perfectly legal, and that kind of thing goes on across the food industry. And the consumers kind of want to be lied to. It's a big mess. But it's an overwhelming force that has nothing to do with the hole in my heart. And then I looked at the addiction treatment industry, and they say, well, you can't stop even if you want to. There's no point trying to quit. Just abstain one day at a time. And the evidence for that is not really true either. That's a whole other story. But so those are three overwhelming forces. And the part of the brain that's responsible for these overwhelming urges, the lizard brain, the most primitive part of our brain, it doesn't really know love. It looks at something in the environment and it says, do I eat it? Do I mate with it? Or do I kill it? Right? Mm-hmm. So you can't love that. You can't love the lizard into acting well. You have to take control. Okay. So the last thing that came into place, and this is actually very relevant for your audience, was that people who are looking for love and not finding it tend to go to chocolate instead. That's one of the things that 40,000 person study found. They tend to be lonely, brokenhearted, or a little depressed. And I was among that. I always used to start my binges with chocolate. That was my favorite thing. People who struggle with starchy, crunchy things like chips and pretzels and that kind of thing, they tend to be stressed at work. And people who struggle with chewy, soft, starchy things like bread and bagels and pasta or pizza, they tend to be stressed at home. So before I decided to work with people about this, I wanted to fix myself. And I went to my mom, who's also a therapist, and I said, how did this get set up? Like, yes, I'm in a bad marriage and I'm kind of brokenhearted. And so it makes sense according to the data, but how did that set up? Why do I rent the chocolate when I feel lonely or brokenhearted? And my mom gets this horrible look on her face. And she says, I'm so sorry, honey. And I said, Mom, it's okay. You know, this is 40 years ago. It would be 50 years ago now, but this was 40 years ago. Whatever it is, I forgive you. I just want to know. I'm trying to figure this out. She goes, honey, I'm so sorry, but when you were 1 year old in 1965, your dad was a captain in the Army. And I was terrified that we were going to send him to Vietnam. At the same time, my dad, your grandpa, he just got out of prison. And he was actually guilty. And he was doing these things. And I'd idolized him my whole life. And so my whole world was falling apart. And I was overwhelmed with everything you needed. And I was sitting and staring at the wall most of the time. And I just couldn't deal with hugging you and feeding you and loving you in the way that you needed to be hugged and fed and loved. So I got a little refrigerator and I put it on the floor. And I put a great big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup in the refrigerator. And when you came running to me for love, I said, honey, go get your Bosco. And you'd go crawling over to the refrigerator. You'd take it out. You'd suck on the cap. You suck on the bottle. And you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma.
Wow.
And like, I have the same look on my face as you have on your face. Yeah. I thought, you know, gee, if this was a movie, then at that point, mom and I would have a great big hug and a great big cry, and I would never have trouble with chocolate again, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, we had a hug and a little cry, and it was a good conversation to have. And I forgave myself. I could be softer on myself about the problem that I was having. Certainly could forgive my mom. I learned all kinds of things about her. Food is very soulful. There's a lot you can learn about. But my chocolate eating got worse. Not better, but worse. Even though I had this great catharsis, it got worse. And the reason it got worse was there was this crazy voice in my head. And it went something like this. Hey, Glenn, you know what? You're right. Our mama didn't love us enough. And she left a great big chocolate-sized hole in our heart. And until we can find the love of our life and get out of this marriage, we're going to have to keep right on binging on chocolate. Let's go get more right now. Yippee. So there was this voice of justification that made it okay that I would binge on chocolate when I felt lonely or depressed. And that was really the pivotal insight, because then I said, all right, so if you think of a fire, and let's say the emotions are a fire, you could have a roaring fire in a well-contained fireplace in the living room, and it becomes the center of hearth and home, and people gather around it, and they make stories and memories. The problem is if there's a hole in the fireplace. And if there's a hole in the fireplace, the ashes can jump out and burn down the house. And it's this voice of justification that makes it okay that pokes holes in that fireplace. It's not a problem. It's not the emotion that's the problem. It's the voice of justification that pokes holes in that fireplace. And it actually turns out to be easier to recognize and disempower those justifications than it was to no longer be too lonely or depressed or brokenhearted or even learn how to live with those feelings. So here's what I did, and this is a little embarrassing for a sophisticated psychologist like me. And I was never going to share this. This was going to be my own private little journal. I decided that my lizard brain was going to be my inner pig. I didn't have to call it a pig. I could have called it a food demon or a monster, but this is a very private thing. A lot of women don't like to call it a pig. They want to call it something different. That's fine. But I called it a pig, and I would make a very bright line to differentiate healthy versus unhealthy behavior for myself. So for example, one of the first things I was struggling with was chocolate. So I said, I will never have chocolate on a weekday again. Very clear, bright line. And then if I heard something in my head that was something like, hey, Glenn, you know, you worked out hard enough today and you could afford it. Might as well start tomorrow, even though it's a Wednesday. Let's go get some chocolate. I would say, well, I don't want that. My pig does. My pig is squealing for pig slop. I don't eat pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And as ridiculous and primitive and embarrassing and crude as that is, I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do is what started to wake me up at the moment of impulse and give me those extra microseconds to remember who I was, what relationship I wanted to have with chocolate, and make the right decision if I wanted to. And it wasn't a miracle. I would still make mistakes. I'd still sometimes make the wrong decision. But what was a miracle was that the sense of powerlessness and confusion and, oh my God, I'm out of control, that all just went away. And slowly over time, as I listened to what the pig had to say and I disempowered it, I just started, I realized that I could make my own rules. No one was telling me what to eat, so I didn't have to give up anything I didn't want to. And I said, I might as well listen to it. I might as well, you know, listen to my own rules, and I'll make rules I can live with. And I kept a journal for a lot of years, and I got thin, and my triglycerides came down, and the doctor stopped yelling at me. And then in 2015, as I was getting divorced, I was a minor partner in a publishing company, and the CEO said he wanted to publish a book of our own so we could attract better authors. And I said, well, I've got this crazy journal, and I sent it to him, and he calls me back a week later, and he says, donuts or pig slop? I don't eat pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And he lost 86 pounds. And,
wow.
And anyway, yeah. So we published it. You know, he and I both had a lifetime in marketing, so we knew what we were doing. But even still, we couldn't imagine how much it was going to take off. And now people don't quite recognize my name, but every now and then I'm in a bookstore, and they point at me and they go, pig guy, which is not what you want to happen on a first date, but that's another story.
Interesting. So. Interesting. Well, now, Glenn, I appreciate you being vulnerable and sharing the story because I know it wasn't easy. But for you, it sounds like you were able to overcome this on your own. And for a lot of other people, it's not so easy to have that willpower and self-control. So what would be your best recommendation to a woman who is still binging? And every time she does, she goes through that cycle of binging and then beating herself up or whatever it is. And then she feels crappy and she can't get out of that cycle.
So what I'm legally allowed to recommend is something you can try in addition to any psychological treatment that you seek or an eating disorder treatment that you seek. And there are a number of components which you just went through which are particularly important to think about. One of them has to do with forgiving yourself. Now, it turns out that this is a pivotal insight, and it doesn't make sense to people at first, so I want you to really think about this. It turns out that the guilt and the shame that gets stuck inside you after you've had a binge or even made, you know, a semi-serious eating mistake, that guilt and shame is intended to get you to binge more. It's actually your inner food demon trying to make you feel too weak to resist the next binge. It's very difficult to keep binging if you refuse to yell at yourself. It's very difficult to keep, and if there's only one thing you take away from the interview, remember that. It's difficult to keep binging. Think about the physical function of pain in the body. If you touch a hot stove, you want to feel that pain for a second because you have to get your attention and figure out how you're going to avoid that stove in the future. But once you know where the stove is and you know you're not going to touch it again, you're not supposed to say, oh my God, I'm pathetic. I'm a pathetic hot stove toucher. I might as well put my whole hand down on the stove right now and burn the whole thing off because there's just no hope for me. No, you're supposed to analyze the mistake, figure out what went wrong, readjust yourselves, and then move on with your life. Same thing if you're aiming at a fool's food bullseye. If you're an archer and you are aiming at a bullseye, before you let go of the arrow, you want to see that arrow going into the target. You want to almost be the arrow and see it going into the target so that you're not distracted. So you want to commit with perfection. You want to really be right on target for the bullseye. If you miss, you're not supposed to shoot all the rest of the arrows up in the air. You're supposed to figure out by how much you miss. So it's that kind of thing. I call it committing with perfection, but forgiving yourself with dignity. And if there were one phrase that the women in your audience remembered that would be helpful to them, that would be the one. The other thing that you can do is you can think about your single worst trigger food or behavior. Most people have a particular MO when it comes to binging. You know, for me, it was chocolate bars. For other people, it could be pizza. Some people, it's something that's seemingly healthy, you know, a particular type of chicken or a particular type of vegetable dish, but there's just something about it that leads them to want something else. And whatever it is, see if you could make one small rule that you know would make a difference. Maybe it's not going to take all the weight off you. Maybe it's not going to fix all of your food problems, but you know it would make a difference and you feel like you could do it. Examples might be, I will always put my fork down between bites, right? Or I'll never eat standing in front of the TV again, or I'll never eat in the car again. Or like for me, it was, I'll only ever have chocolate on the weekends again. Mm-hmm. Make one rule and then listen to yourself try to break it. Define any thought, feeling, image, or impulse that suggests you will ever break that rule again as your inner food demon, your inner pig, whatever you want to call it. Now, here's the trick. If you know it's coming from the pig, then you could ignore it. You don't have to do that. The reason a lot of people have difficulty with that is twofold. First of all, sometimes they're not meeting their authentic bodily needs. Overeaters tend to be over-dieters also. They tend to be good at losing weight, then even better at gaining it back and more. Mm-hmm. And they get themselves stuck in this feast and famine cycle. And so if you pay more attention to regularly, reliably having nutrition coursing through your veins, then the strength of the cravings will not be as strong. And the pig squeal that you hear, the rationalization that your inner enemy gives you for indulging, it's not going to seem anywhere near as reasonable if your body is well-fed and well-nourished. Most people will notice that they have the hardest time sticking with their rule when they missed a meal or they skipped breakfast or they'd had something that wasn't really so balanced before. So really, really pay careful attention to your nutrition so the cravings are not that strong. And then start keeping a list of all the things that your pig says and ask yourself, are they logical or not? The pig will say, you've tried 1,000 times before, why is this any different? You know, you've always failed before, therefore you have to fail in the future. Well, if you take a highway for 1,000 miles without getting off at an exit, does that mean you can't take the next one? So you're kind of disempowered. The pig will say, it's just as easy to start tomorrow. You know, you'll be about the same weight. Who cares? Let's just have one more day. Well, the truth there is that by the principle of neuroplasticity, what fires together wires together. If you have a craving and you indulge it, it's going to be stronger tomorrow. So you're either always reinforcing or extinguishing your addictions. If you are in a hole, stop digging. So it's not as easy tomorrow. It's harder tomorrow. You always use the present moment to be healthy. So keep a list of all the things that your pig says and then challenge them so that you'll more easily recognize the lies within them. And then watch yourself reclaim your power, reclaim a sense of hope and enthusiasm, and move forward. Move forward. It's not quite as simple as it all sounds. I don't mean to make light of it, but that process of structuring your thinking can be a pivotal insight that changes your life. So,
right. Well, yeah. No, of course it's not easy. But you mentioned something that I find very interesting. You said if somebody binges, right, one night, that the urge will be stronger tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
And so my question for you is it a good idea for someone to do a detox, and then is it easier for them to get on a real plan that they can stick with so that they don't end up binging again?
I am highly in favor. I can't dispute the medical benefits of detoxing or fasting or intermittent fasting. I see a lot of good things happen to people with that. However, for binge eaters, I think it's a mistake in the first 6 months to a year. Once you're over this, and you really can get over it, but once you're over it for 6 months to a year, then you can start the detoxes. The problem is that I believe there's an evolutionary mechanism in our brain that says if we're in an environment where food and nutrition and calories are scarce, mm-hmm. then the moment that they're available, we'd better hoard them.
Right.
And a lot of women listening probably have had the experience, like someone is pointing a gun to their head and is saying, you better eat. A lot of people, they're overeating. They're not even getting pleasure from the food. They just feel like they have to do it. And my experience is that the long fasts, the detoxes, they can trigger that. So what I tell people is it would be great to get sugar, flour, and alcohol out of your system for a month. That'll make a big difference. But don't have these long periods where you're undernourished or under-caloried so that your body can detox. Let that happen later.
Yeah. And, you know, Glenn, I'll share my own personal experience. I used to be a total sugar addict. I was really bad. Like, I had to have sugar every day. And it was so bad that sometimes I'd wake up in the morning and eat sugar. This was in my 20s. And when I did a detox, here's what happened after I went off the detox and I ate M&Ms for the first time is it tasted really weird to me. And I didn't crave it like I used to. That's why I was asking about that, because it's interesting to me.
Well, so what I would suggest you do, this is how I got off of chocolate, as a matter of fact. I heard Jack Trimpe say in a recording that when he was helping people with smoking, if they had a craving, that they were having a biological error, that the lungs were mistaking the smoke for oxygen. And so when they had the craving, if they could step outside and take three very deep breaths and three sighs, that they'd be giving their body what they needed and retraining the biological drive to go where it needed to go. I find that's true for most cravings. So for chocolate, for me, I experimented with things that I could substitute for it. And I eventually came upon kale juice and bananas. So I make a mixture of kale juice and bananas, and I would run and drink it down when I had the chocolate craving. And of course, in my head, there's this voice that says, that sounds disgusting. Are you out of your mind? It's not going to taste good at all.
Right.
And it doesn't taste good at first. But 6 to 8 weeks later, I was craving the kale juice and the bananas. So what I recommend is that rather than trying to force your body into an intense detox by reducing your calories and nutrition to almost nothing, so you have no digestive burden, just ease the digestive burden, eat some healthy things instead of what you're craving, and watch how your body adjusts, and the cravings adjust.
Oh, I love that. That's a great hack. Well, I don't know if you call it a hack, but I feel like it's a hack, because if your mind's telling you that you want chocolate and then you're doing kale juice and bananas, I think that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a hack, I guess. Celery juice for salt cravings, too. I had some celery juice for salt cravings that worked.
That's right, because celery has sodium in it, correct?
Yeah, and some other minerals. The other thing that worked for salt cravings was I would put about a pound of leafy green vegetables in the blender with some water, and I would drink it all down. And I don't know why that works for salt cravings. There must be some type of mineral composition that takes them away, but it's also very unique to each person. Just because that worked for me doesn't mean it'll work for you, but you can experiment. Most people know how to eat healthy.
Right. Now, I think that's great that you said that what may work for you may not work for somebody else, but you just got to test things out, right? But I think you gave a lot of great tips on how a woman can overcome the binging if she's doing that. And your story was so interesting to find out the source of why you were craving chocolate. That's fascinating.
Yeah. I used this method with my mom, by the way. After we talked about all that, she died a couple of years ago. But the last year of her life, she said, Glenn, for 77 years, I've eaten all the chocolate on Halloween. I said, all the leftover chocolate, I always eat it. And can you coach me so I get this year I don't have to eat the chocolate? And I coached her not to have the chocolate, and it worked. So she got 1 year where she didn't have to overeat the chocolate after that story. So.
Oh, I love that story. Well, this has been amazing. So, Glenn, can you tell the ladies where they can find you and your book?
It's all at neverbingeagain.com. And if you go there and you click the big red button, neverbingeagain.com, you'll see a reader bonus list. If you sign up for that, I'll give you three things. One is a copy of the book for free in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format. We have paperback and Audible, but there's a charge for that. But electronic formats are free. We also have a set of food plan starter templates. So regardless of whether you are low carb or high carb or point counters or calorie counters or vegan or ketogenic, whatever you're doing, there's a set of example food rules that you can customize for your own use. Because we've worked with, I think it's almost 1,000 clients at this point. The third thing is, I know this sounds weird and harsh in the abstract. I know you must be thinking, why does Susan have this psychologist on that has a pig inside him? It just doesn't make sense. But I promise you that it's very compassionate in its execution. And if you listen to people being coached through the whole process from beginning to end, you'll see that they go from having a sense of despair and hopelessness and confusion and powerlessness to feeling in control and enthusiastic in just one session. So I think that's very inspiring for people to hear, and it will make you less likely to want to put my picture on a dartboard and throw darts at it. So neverbingeagain.com, click the big red button.
Awesome. Ladies, so that, first of all, Glenn, that's so generous that you give away your book for free in electronic format. That's amazing. So ladies, if you'd like to go get his free book, just go to his site. And thanks everybody for joining us on the It's Never Too Late show. Our show is available both in video format and podcast format. If you would like to view the videos, you can go to yournextamazingstory.com. And if you like to download the podcast, you can download it from Apple Podcasts. And if you would like to get our free ebook, How to Create Your Next Amazing Story in 3 Simple Steps, you can click right here on the video, or you can go to yournextamazingstory.com.
Love today's episode of the It's Never Too Late show? Then head on over to yournextamazingstory.com to continue the conversation, get access to show notes, and get more amazing content.